The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, my name is Kate, and I'll be reading various articles to you about diabetes. Our first article is entitled, Misfolded Insulin May Be Quietly Driving Diabetes. The source is Sanford Burnham Presbyterian. Much like paper must be folded into the correct shape to create an origami sculpture, proteins inside cells must form precise three-dimensional structures before they can function properly. As prediabetes advances toward diabetes, this delicate process can begin to break down. Misfolded and defective proteins accumulate inside cells, creating stress that can damage the pancreatic cells responsible for producing insulin. Researchers from Sanford Burnham Presbyterian Medical Discovery Institute and the University of Michigan reported new details about this process in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Their findings reveal how insulin-producing cells coordinate protein folding and what happens when that system falls out of balance. The work suggests that strengthening the cellular machinery responsible for folding proteins could help protect these cells from damage. Beta cells in the pancreas monitor blood sugar levels. When glucose rises, they respond by producing additional insulin, which helps return blood sugar to a normal range. As diabetes progresses, however, beta cells increasingly struggle to meet the body's demand for insulin. Previous research has linked this decline to the misfolding of proinsulin, the precursor protein cells used to make insulin. Scientists already knew that improperly folded proinsulin accumulates during diabetes and places stress on pancreatic beta cells. What remained uncertain was which additional proteins help control the process and how they work together. We knew that the system for preventing proinsulin misfolding depended on a chaperone protein called the binding immunoglobulin protein and a number of co-chaperones, said Randall J. Kaufman, Ph.D., a professor in the Center for Metabolic and Liver Diseases at Sanford Burnham Presbyterian and senior and corresponding author of the study. Our goal was to examine how these protein partners coordinate pro-insulin folding and remove any misfolded mistakes, as these steps are essential for the health of insulin-producing cells. To study the interactions of binding immunoglobulin protein, or BIP, the researchers genetically modified mice so that BIP in their beta cells carried an additional amino acid chain called a peptide. The added marker consisted of three copies of an 8-amino acid sequence known as 3X flag tag. It acted like a molecular beacon, allowing scientists to detect and isolate BIP more easily during experiments. The results pointed to an especially important role for P58-IPK, one of BIP's co-chaperone proteins. When researchers genetically removed P58-IPK from two different cell lines, misfolded proinsulin accumulated at higher levels. Tests in mice engineered not to produce P58-IPK produced similar evidence. Their beta cells made smaller amounts of both proinsulin and insulin. The team then restored P58-IPK in one of the modified cell lines. Reintroducing the protein improved the cell's ability to fold and transport proinsulin while reducing the accumulation of improperly folded copies. However, P58-IPK could not replace BIP's central role. Those improvements did not occur unless BIP was also present. The researchers next investigated whether increasing BIP could compensate for the absence of P58-IPK. When cells produced extra BIP but lacked P58-IPK, they showed only modest gains in proinsulin folding and its movement out of the cell. The improvements were substantially greater when both proteins were present at normal levels. Like a single tennis player trying to play a doubles match, we found that BIP cannot just go it alone in maintaining the proper folding of proinsulin, said Insuk Jang, PhD, a staff scientist in the Kaufman Library Lab, and lead author of the manuscript. The investigators also identified additional partner proteins involved in folding and transporting proinsulin, as well as detecting and managing misfolded versions. More research will be needed to determine precisely how these proteins influence insulin production and the progression of diabetes. Our studies highlight that proinsulin folding is vulnerable to many of the same cellular stresses that cause beta cell failure and type 2 diabetes, said Kaufman. Most existing diabetes medications do not directly correct the protein folding problems that may contribute to beta cell failure. Instead, they primarily control the disease by helping tissues absorb more glucose or prompting the pancreas to release more insulin. No current therapies are designed to improve proinsulin folding in order to preserve the health and function of beta cells. If we can learn how to influence the coordinated activity of BIP as a key regulator of proinsulin folding, we may find a promising treatment strategy for intervening early to prevent or reduce damage to insulin-producing cells, said Kaufman. Our next article is entitled, Why Do Only Some People Get Type 2 Diabetes? A Study Sheds New Light. The source is SciTechDaily.com. An Oregon State University study explains why not all obese patients get type 2 diabetes. A new analytical technique developed by researchers at Oregon State University provides insight into a long-standing type 2 diabetes mystery, why some obese individuals get the disease while others don't. 1 in 10 Americans has type 2 diabetes, a serious metabolic disease. It is a condition that impacts how the body metabolizes glucose, a sugar that is a major source of energy. The condition was once known as adult-onset diabetes. This kind of diabetes is frequently associated with obesity. For some people, this means that their body does not react to insulin as it should. Instead, it fights against insulin's effects. Insulin is a hormone generated by the pancreas that facilitates the entry of sugar into cells. When the pancreas is worn down in the latter stages of the disease, individuals are unable to generate enough insulin to keep their blood sugar levels within the normal range. In either scenario, blood sugar levels rise, and if ignored, the consequence weakens several important organs, sometimes severely or even fatally. Being overweight, which is often brought on by consuming excessive amounts of fat and sugar, together with little physical exercise, is a major risk factor for type 2 diabetes. To investigate the processes behind early-stage systemic insulin resistance, Andre Morgan, Natalia Shulzenko, and Giorgio Trinicheri of the National Cancer Institute created a novel analytical method known as multi-organ network analysis. The scientists wanted to know what organs, biological pathways, and genes were involved. The results, which demonstrate how a certain kind of gut microbe causes white adipose tissue to contain macrophage cells, large immune system cells associated with insulin resistance, were published in the Journal of Experimental Medicine. In the human body, white adipose tissue is the main type of fat. Our experiments and analysis predict that a high-fat, high-sugar diet primarily acts in white adipose tissue by driving microbiota-related damage to the energy synthesis process, leading to systemic insulin resistance, said Morgan, associate professor of pharmaceutical sciences at the OSU College of Pharmacy. Treatments that modify a patient's microbiome data in ways that target insulin resistance in adipose tissues, macrophage cells, could be a new therapeutic strategy for type 2 diabetes. The human gut microbiome features more than 10 trillion microbial cells from about 1,000 different bacterial species. Morgan and Chilzenko, an associate professor in OSU's Carlson College of Veterinary Medicine, in earlier research developed a computational method, trans-kingdom network analysis, that predicts specific types of bacteria controlling the expression of mammalian genes connected to specific medical conditions, such as diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is a global pandemic, and the number of diagnoses is expected to keep increasing over the next 10 years, Chilzenko said. The so-called Western diet, high in saturated fats and refined sugars, is one of the primary factors. But gut bacteria have an important role to play in mediating the effects of diet. In the new study, the scientists relied on both trans-kingdom network analysis and multi-organ network analysis. They also conducted experiments in mice, looking at the intestine, liver, muscle, and white adipose tissue, and examined the molecular signature, which genes were being expressed, of what white adipose tissue macrophages in obese human patients. Diabetes induced by the Western diet is characterized by microbiota-dependent mitochondrial damage, Morgan said. Adipose tissue has a predominant role in systemic insulin resistance, and we characterized the gene expression program and the key master regulator of adipose tissue, macrophage, that is associated with insulin resistance. We discovered that the Acylobacter microbe, enriched by a Western diet, causes an increase of the insulin-resistant adipose tissue macrophage. The researchers add, however, that Acylobacter is likely not the only microbial regulator for the expression of the key gene they identified, MMP12, and that the MMP12 pathway, while clearly instrumental, is probably not the only important pathway depending on which gut microbes are present. We previously showed that Rambutia ileus worsens glucose tolerance by inhibiting insulin levels, which may be relevant to more advanced stages of type 2 diabetes, Chilzenko said. Our next article is entitled Double Jeopardy, Food Insecurity and Diabetes. The source is the University of South Carolina Arnold School of Public Health. 1 in 5 youth and young adults with diabetes in the U.S. lives in a household with limited or uncertain availability of nutritional food, a precarious situation that makes coping with diabetes difficult. While the combination of food insecurity and diabetes has been much studied among older adults, a University of South Carolina public health professor and her team are among the first to focus on the burden of food insecurity in youth and young adults with diabetes who are at higher risk for negative consequences. Food insecure young adults with diabetes are in a real bind when it comes to managing their glucose, says Angela D. Leese, an epidemiology professor in the Arnold School of Public Health, who has conducted diabetes and food insecurity research for more than two decades. One of the most recent research articles documents that the limited or unreliable availability of food correlates with the markedly higher levels of fear of having abnormally low blood sugar. Such fear is well placed, Lise says. Very low blood sugar, a condition known as hypoglycemia, can be life-threatening, and young individuals with type 1 or type 2 diabetes who experience hypoglycemia are believed to be at much higher risk for impaired cognitive function. Lise and her research team recently concluded a Centers for Disease Control-funded study in South Carolina, Washington, California, Colorado, and Ohio, which helped reveal the prevalence and causal effects of youth and young adults with diabetes who experience food insecurity. A follow-up study, funded by the National Institutes for Health, is focused on about 1,100 households in South Carolina, Colorado, and Washington. Being depressed or anxious makes it less likely that you're going to be able to manage your diabetes well. For young people with diabetes, not knowing where your next meal is coming from takes a psychological and emotional toll, and we see much higher rates of depressive symptoms and anxiety in our study population, Lise says. Being depressed or anxious makes it less likely that you are going to be able to manage your diabetes well. Diabetes Care, a leading academic journal, has recently published several articles Lise and her team have distilled from their research on food insecurity and youth and young adults with diabetes. Those topics have included the prevalence and predictors of food insecurity, as well as the fear of hypoglycemia experienced by that population who are dealing with food insecurity. The Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics has recently accepted for publication another article from Lisi's team that focuses on food insecurity and dietary intake in the entire population of youth and adults with diabetes. Findings from that research reveal diets very poor in recommended intake of nearly all of 10 key nutrients: calcium, fiber, magnesium, potassium, sodium, vitamins C, D, E, saturated fat, and added sugar. The researchers found that those with type 1 diabetes generally consume foods with too much sodium and not enough fiber. While the federally funded Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly the Food Stamp Program, helps supplement the food budget of families that need support, more policy-level action is needed to address continuing shortfalls in the system, Lisi says. People with diabetes already have much higher expenditures in daily life. These supplies that you need to test your blood sugar level every day are expensive, as are the medications, Lisi says. And you need to test not just once, but up to four times a day. If you don't have health insurance, it's a real challenge. So people stretch their medication or go without medication, and none of that is good for their health. As the Arnold School team continues to comb through data collected in their research, Lisi is looking ahead to the next logical step, an intervention study that addresses all factors associated with food insecurity and diabetes management. The ultimate goal of any intervention we plan is that a person will be better able to manage their diabetes so that their blood sugar levels stay more in the range that they need to be in, but also that their mental health and their quality of life is good, she says, and that will take a very holistic interventionist approach. Our next article is entitled, Can Sparkling Water Boost Metabolism and Help with Weight Loss? The source is the BMJ Group. Sparkling water may play a small role in weight management by slightly increasing blood glucose uptake and metabolism, which is the process the body uses to convert energy. However, the effect appears to be minimal. A brief analysis published in BMJ Nutrition Prevention and Health concludes that carbonated water alone is not enough to drive meaningful weight loss. The author stresses that there is no simple solution for losing weight and keeping it off. Regular exercise and a balanced, healthy diet remain essential. In addition, the long-term effects of consuming large amounts of carbonated water are still unclear. Sparkling water is often seen as a helpful tool because it can create a feeling of fullness, which may reduce hunger. It has also been suggested that it could speed up digestion and help lower blood glucose levels, leading some to view it as a potential aid for weight loss. Despite these claims, the exact way carbonated water might lower blood glucose is not well understood. It is also unclear how any such effect would translate into meaningful weight management benefits. To explore this further, the author compared drinking fizzy water to hemodialysis, a medical process in which blood is filtered or dialyzed to remove waste and excess fluid when the kidneys can no longer perform this function. This comparison draws on findings from earlier research. During hemodialysis, the blood becomes more alkaline, mainly due to the production of carbon dioxide, or CO2. In a similar way, the CO2 in carbonated water is absorbed through the stomach lining and quickly converted into bicarbonate, or HCO3, within red blood cells. This shift towards alkalinity may activate certain enzymes that increase how quickly glucose is absorbed and used by the body. Observations from clinical settings show that blood glucose levels drop as blood moves through the dialyzer, even when the starting glucose level in the dialysate solution is higher. Although these findings suggest that fizzy water could slightly improve how the body uses glucose, the overall impact is very limited. Context is important, the author notes. In a standard 4-hour hemodialysis session, about 48,000 milliliters of blood passes through the dialyzer. This process results in roughly 9.5 grams of glucose being used. Given this minimal glucose reduction, the impact of CO2 in carbonated water is not a standalone solution for weight loss. A balanced diet and regular physical activity remains crucial components of sustainable weight management, he insists. The author also points out that carbonated water can affect the digestive system, especially in people with sensitive stomachs or existing gastrointestinal issues. Also, drinking carbonated water can have some effects on the digestive system, particularly for individuals with sensitive stomachs or pre-existing gastrointestinal conditions. The primary concerns include bloating, gas, and in some cases, exacerbation of certain symptoms associated with digestive disorders, such as irritable bowel syndrome or gastroesophageal reflux disease, he explains. Moderation is key to avoiding discomfort while still enjoying the possible metabolic benefits of carbonated water, he says. Professor Sumantra Ray, executive director of the NNED Pro Global Institute for Food, Nutrition, and Health, which co-owns the journal, emphasized that the findings are still preliminary. While there is a hypothetical link between carbonated water and glucose metabolism, this is yet to be tested in well-designed human intervention studies. And although this study adds to the evidence base, it doesn't provide sufficient evidence on which to make recommendations for the preventive or therapeutic use of carbonated water. Additionally, any potential benefits must be weighed up against the potential harms of carbonated water, which may contain sodium, glucose, or other additives. Our next article is entitled AI Platform and Blood Test May Better Predict Diabetes Risk. The source is Medical News. Because symptoms take a long time to develop or may not show themselves at all, it can be very hard for doctors to diagnose type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes develops slowly. By the time of diagnosis, adverse changes to the heart, kidneys, or blood vessels may have already begun. Jun Lee, MD, PhD, and Assistant Professor of Medicine and Associate Epidemiologist in the Department of Medicine at Mass General Brigham, told Medical News Today. Current risk evaluation tools rely largely on risk factors such as age, body weight, family history, and blood sugar levels. Although helpful, these measures do not capture the underlying biological changes that lead to diabetes, and many people who eventually develop the disease are not flagged as high risk early enough. Because of these issues, researchers are focusing on finding new ways of diagnosing type 2 diabetes earlier. The study proposes that the AMI model is more effective than the standard HbA1c test, which measures a person's average blood sugar levels over 3 months. Additionally, Lee is both the first and co-corresponding author of the study recently published in Nature Medicine, which found small molecules in the blood that may help doctors predict a person's future type 2 diabetes risk beyond traditional risk factors. The first study revolves around an AI platform called GluFormer, a generative foundation model for continuous glucose monitoring, or CGM. The AI platform was data trained through self-supervised learning, using more than 10 million glucose measurements from almost 11,000 adults, most of whom did not have diabetes. In a study with 580 participants, scientists reported GluFormer identified participants at an increased risk for diabetes and death from cardiovascular disease more effectively than the HbA1c test. Over a median follow-up period of 11 years, researchers found that 66% of participants considered in the highest risk category by GluFormer went on to develop diabetes, while only 7% of those in the lowest risk category developed the condition. When looking at cardiovascular death risk, 69% of those categorized as high risk died from heart-related conditions, while no deaths occurred among participants in the lowest risk group. Additionally, researchers reported that the GluFormer platform was able to pick out participants with prediabetes who were most likely to experience significant increases in their HbA1c readings over a 2-year period, better than baseline HbA1c and common CGM metrics. Our printable list compiles our favorite nutritious snack ideas to help you manage your blood sugar levels. Join our Type 2 Diabetes newsletter for your free copy and expert guidance twice a week. MMT had the opportunity to speak with David Cutler, MD, a board-certified family medicine physician at Providence St. John's Health Center in Santa Monica, California, who was not involved in this study, about this new AI model. It is welcome news about a new AI application of blood sugar measurements, which is a better predictor than our traditional tools of both future diabetes and cardiovascular deaths, Cutler commented. Traditionally, we have simply used serial hemoglobin A1C measurements to see who is at risk of developing diabetes. We would combine this with measurements of cholesterol, weight, kidney function, coronary calcium, age, and smoking history to estimate future risks of cardiovascular events. This new AI application of continuous glucose measurements seems to give more accurate estimations of future risk than our current tools. The question remains whether better risk prediction with the GluFormer model of CGM data will lead to better outcomes, he continued. Once patients are told they are more likely to develop diabetes or have a heart attack, will they take the medication, change their behaviors, and undergo procedures which will treat diabetes and prevent heart attacks and strokes? Will the cost for the CGM devices and data interpretation be acceptable to payers, whether that be individuals or insurance companies? And what additional steps will need to be taken to transition healthcare providers from using traditional risk assessment tools to a new, better, but less familiar technology? In the past, it has often taken a decade or more once a new test, treatment, or technology has shown proven benefit for it to be incorporated into routine practice, Cutler added. This has certainly been the case for blood pressure, cholesterol, and diabetes control measures. Next steps should include not only assurance of the benefits of the Glueformer technology, but the process for implementation, which will yield significant beneficial results. In the second study, Lee and her team identified metabolites that may help predict a person's future risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Metabolites are small molecules found in our blood that are produced during our body's daily activities, such as natural biological processes to maintain function when we eat, store, or use energy, and respond to everyday activities like exercise, Lee explained. They are chemical footprints that can reflect how well the body's metabolism is working at a given moment. In this study, we found that certain metabolites begin to change years before type 2 diabetes develops, she continued. These changes reflect early dysfunctions in terms of how the body processes sugar, fats, energy, and nutrients before blood sugar levels become high enough for a person to be diagnosed as having type 2 diabetes. We also found that combination of metabolites in the blood can better predict future risk of type 2 diabetes. At the study's conclusion, researchers found that diet and lifestyle factors may have a stronger impact on metabolites correlated with type 2 diabetes than on metabolites not linked to the condition. They also found that the metabolites associated with type 2 diabetes were also genetically linked to clinical traits and tissue types that are connected to the condition. This genetic evidence allows researchers to move beyond identifying risk biomarkers toward understanding disease mechanisms, and deeper understanding of disease mechanisms can guide the development of more targeted prevention strategies and, in the longer term, help identify new therapeutic targets for type 2 diabetes, Lee added. We rounded up a few nutritious and delicious recipes for you to try next time you need inspiration in the kitchen. Join our type 2 diabetes newsletter for your free recipes and expert guidance twice a week. Our next article is entitled, "This Cheap Drug Could Help People with Type 1 Diabetes Use Less Insulin." The source is the Garvan Institute of Medical Research. A new clinical trial led by the Garvan Institute of Medical Research suggests that metformin, a widely used and inexpensive drug for type 2 diabetes, could help people with type 1 diabetes reduce how much insulin they need. The findings point to a potential new way to manage the condition more effectively. For years, doctors have prescribed metformin to some people with type 1 diabetes in hopes of improving insulin resistance. That approach has mostly been based on limited evidence. Now, results from a controlled clinical trial show that while metformin does not improve insulin resistance in type 1 diabetes, it does help lower the amount of insulin required to keep blood sugar levels within a healthy range. Published in Nature Communications, the study highlights a surprising benefit that could ease the daily challenges faced by people who rely on insulin therapy. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease that affects more than 130,000 Australians. In this condition, the immune system attacks the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. As a result, patients must take insulin for life to control their blood sugar. Managing the disease can be demanding. People with type 1 diabetes make an estimated 180 additional daily decisions related to monitoring and adjusting their blood sugar levels. Over time, some patients develop insulin resistance, meaning their bodies respond less effectively to insulin. This can lead to higher and higher doses being needed to maintain stable blood sugar. Insulin resistance is a growing problem in type 1 diabetes. Not only does it make regulating blood sugar levels difficult, but it is an underappreciated risk factor for heart disease, which is one of the biggest causes of health complications and deaths in those with type 1 diabetes, said Dr. Jennifer Snaith, endocrinologist, and co-lead of the study. To better understand whether metformin could help, researchers conducted the first randomized controlled trial of its kind in adults with type 1 diabetes. The study, known as the Insulin Resistance in Type 1 Diabetes Managed with Metformin, or INTIMET, study, examined whether the drug could reduce insulin resistance in this group. Metformin is commonly used to treat type 2 diabetes and is already prescribed off-label to as many 13,000 Australians with type 1 diabetes. However, its exact effect in this population has remained unclear. We randomized 40 adults with long-term type 1 diabetes to take metformin or a placebo for 6 months. We examined whether their insulin resistance changed over that time through a sophisticated and comprehensive research technique called a clamp study that allowed us to map insulin resistance in different parts of the body, explains Professor Greenfield. The results did not match expectations. Researchers found no improvement in insulin resistance and no significant changes in blood sugar levels among those taking metformin. However, one key finding stood out. Participants who took metformin needed about 12% less insulin than those in the placebo group to maintain stable blood sugar. Although we didn't find changes to insulin resistance from the use of metformin, we did show that people taking it used around 12% less insulin than those on placebo. This is an important result. Insulin is a relatively old treatment which, while life-saving, comes with significant mental and physical burden. This means that lowering the amount of insulin used is a priority for many people living with type 1 diabetes. We have shown that a very cheap, accessible medication may serve this purpose, and this is very exciting, Dr. Snaith says. Researchers are now working to understand why metformin reduces insulin needs if it does not affect insulin resistance. Professor Greenfield explains, metformin has been available in various forms for around 100 years, but its mechanism of action remains unknown. We would have expected that the observed reductions in insulin dose induced by metformin in our study would be due to the body becoming more sensitive to insulin, that is, becoming less insulin resistant. But we have shown that this is not the case. Our priority is now working out how metformin is achieving this effect. One leading idea involves the gut microbiome. Scientists suspect that metformin may influence gut bacteria in ways that affect how the body processes glucose. There is increasing evidence suggesting that metformin may act on the gut. This is why we are now investigating how metformin changes gut flora, also known as the microbiome, in people with type 1 diabetes. This has not been studied before in type 1 diabetes. We're hoping this will provide clues on metformin's mechanism of action so that it can be more widely used in the management of type 1 diabetes, adds Dr. Snaith. Our next article is Mothers Who Are Obese, Diabetic, Are More Likely to Have Children with Autism. John Hopkins study offers new evidence that autism develops in utero. The source is John Hopkins. Autism is more common in children born to mothers with obesity and diabetes, a new John Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health study suggests. Researchers found that mothers with both conditions were at least 4 times more likely than healthy weight mothers to give birth to children diagnosed on the autism spectrum. Their findings, published in the journal Pediatrics, contribute to growing evidence that the risk of autism develops before birth. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the prevalence of autism has skyrocketed since the 1960s, with 1 in 68 children in the U.S. now affected by the neurodevelopmental condition. Over the same time period, obesity and diabetes have also reached epidemic levels in women of childbearing age. Though previous research has linked autism to maternal diabetes, this Hopkins study is believed to be the first to look at obesity and diabetes in tandem as risk factors. Researchers analyzed 2,734 mother-child pairs from the Boston Medical Center between 1998 and 2014. They followed the babies from birth through childhood, identifying 102 diagnoses of the autism spectrum disorder. Their findings revealed that obese mothers with diabetes, whether pre-pregnancy or gestational, were more than 4 times as likely to have children with autism. It's important for us to now try to figure out what is it about the combination of obesity and diabetes that is potentially contributing to suboptimal fetal health. Though both diabetes and obesity are known to cause general stress on the body, scientists don't yet fully understand the biology of why the two conditions contribute to autism risk. Previous research has linked maternal obesity with inflammation of the fetal brain and lower levels of folate, a B vitamin essential for development. Regardless of the future studies warranted, the Hopkins researchers stress that better management of weight and diabetes can have lifelong impacts on both mother and child. In order to prevent autism, we may need to consider not only pregnancy, but also pre-pregnancy health, Fallon says. Our next article is entitled Wegovy Pill. How does it compare to injections and what are the side effects? The source is Medical News. Until now, Wegovy was only available as a self-injection taken once a week. Wegovy contains the active ingredient semaglutide, which is also found in other GLP-1 medications like Ozempic and Rybelsus. Medical News Today spoke with 3 obesity medicine experts to find out more about the Wegovy pill, why it's a game changer, how it's different from the Wegovy injections, and tips for figuring out which form of Wegovy is right for you. We asked about the importance of the availability of the Wegovy pill. Seth Kipnis, MD, Director of Bariatric and Robotic Surgery at Hackensack Meridian Jersey Shore University Medical Center in New Jersey, said that GLP-1 pills represent a pivotal moment in obesity medicine and represents a significant leap forward in patient accessibility and treatment adherence. The most obvious and impactful change is the removal of the psychological and physical barrier of self-injection, Kipnis told MNT. Needle phobia is a real and significant reason why many potential candidates for GLP-1 therapy refuse treatment. Daily pill intake is common for many medications, potentially leading to better long-term adherence, which is critical for chronic weight management. Pill form helps normalize the medical treatment of obesity, framing it less as an intensive, specialized intervention and more like the management of other chronic conditions, such as hypertension or hyperlipidemia, which are typically treated with oral medications, says Seth Kipnis. Devika Umashankar, System Medical Director for Obesity Medicine at Hartford Healthcare and the Medical and Surgical Weight Loss Hartford Healthcare Digestive Health Institute in Connecticut, told MNT that the recent approval of the Wegovy pill is a game changer because one of the biggest challenges with once-a-week injectable medications are side effects that can persist for up to a week. In contrast, daily medications' side effects can resolve within 24 hours, minimizing prolonged side effects for patients. Mir Ali, MD, a board-certified general surgeon, bariatric surgeon, and medical director of Memorial Care Surgical Weight Loss Center at Orange Coast Medical Center in Fountain Valley, California, added that typically pills are cheaper to manufacture than injections, so that may potentially bring the costs down, whether a user is going through insurance or not. And the big factor still remains that when insurance companies might cover this and what criteria they might have for that, Ali added. The most obvious difference between the Wegovy pill and injection is in how the medication is delivered, either orally or subcutaneous injection, and how frequently. The Wegovy pill is taken once a day on an empty stomach. Pill users are told to wait at least 30 minutes before eating, drinking, or taking any other medications to allow the Wegovy pill time to be absorbed. The distinctive difference is the pill provides greater flexibility in how patients choose to take their medication, Umashankar explained. In terms of weight loss, the pill form provides a 14% weight loss in 64 weeks. The injectable form provides a less than 15% weight loss in greater than a year. Both provide approximately the same weight loss. As for side effects, Kipnis said that Wegovy formulations are very similar, with gastrointestinal issues, GI, such as nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and constipation, being the most common for both. However, he did mention there are a few nuances. While both cause GI side effects, the daily administration of the pill might lead to more frequent, albeit potentially less intense, GI events, as the gut is exposed to the medication every day. The clinical trial data showed high rates of nausea, such as 46.6%, and vomiting, such as 30.9%, for the oral version, said Seth Kipnis, MD. The pill's effectiveness is highly dependent on strict adherence to the dosing instructions. Empty stomach and waiting period, Kipnis continued. Failure to follow these rules could lead to reduced efficacy or variable absorption, which is not a concern with the injection. And because the pill contains the absorption enhancer SNAC, which is present in human milk, breastfeeding is not recommended during treatment with Wegovy tablets, he continued. This is a specific contradiction for the pill that does not apply to the injection, for which alternative formulations can be used during lactation, he added. For readers deciding which form of Wegovy to take, oral pill or self-injection, Umashankar advises having a conversation with a medical provider to determine which type of Wegovy would be best for the patient. This conversation can lead to a more individualized approach and provide options for long-term adherence, she explains. Before prescribing oral semaglutide, I think it is essential to understand the patient's experience with pharmacologic treatment for obesity to provide effective care. Understanding what has and has not worked previously and partnering with the patient to develop a comprehensive plan is essential. Such as, you have a strong aversion to needles or the idea of self-injecting, or you have a very consistent morning routine and can reliably take a pill on an empty stomach and wait 30 minutes before your coffee or breakfast. Or you prefer the psychological comfort of a daily pill, which feels more like traditional medicine. Or your mornings are hectic and you know you'll struggle with the strict empty stomach rule. or you prefer the convenience of a one-and-done weekly task and not having to think about your medication every day, or you are comfortable with self-injection or are willing to learn. Regardless of which form of Wegovy you take, Allie says to be the most successful in losing weight with the help of these medications, the main thing to remember is none of this is magic. You still have to make the right food choices, do the right things, he explains. We emphasize to our patients to reduce carbohydrates and sugars and emphasize protein and vegetables in the diet. Protein intake is very important because we want you to preserve muscle. You don't want to lose muscle, and you want to preserve the muscle and burn off the fat. So if you eliminate or reduce as much as possible carbohydrates and sugars, that's going to direct the body towards burning the fat more, and that's the goal, Ali added. These medications are very useful tools to help patients get on the right track, but like any other tool, it has to be used properly. Our next article is entitled, The Type of Carbs You Eat May Affect Dementia Risk. The source is the University of Rovira y Virgili in Spain, from ScienceDaily.com. New research suggests that both the amount and the type of carbohydrates people eat may strongly influence their risk of developing dementia. The findings come from a collaborative study conducted by the Nutrition and Metabolic Health, or NUMI, research group at the University Rovira y Virgili, or URV, the Center for Environmental, Food, and Toxicological Technology, or TICNATOX, and the Pierre Virgili Health Research Institute, IISPV. The study was published in the scientific journal International Journal of Epidemiology. While age remains one of the strongest risk factors for dementia, researchers emphasize that lifestyle choices also play an important role. A healthy routine, particularly a well-balanced diet, can help slow cognitive decline and support healthier aging. Carbohydrates make up the largest share of most diets, providing about 55% of daily energy intake. Because carbohydrates directly affect blood sugar and insulin levels, their quality and quantity can have a major impact on metabolic health and diseases linked to brain functioning, including Alzheimer's. A key focus of the study was the glycemic index, or GI, a measure of how quickly carbohydrate-containing foods raise blood glucose levels after eating. The GI scale, from 0 to 100, ranks foods based on this response. Items such as white bread and potatoes score high, meaning they cause rapid spikes in blood sugar, while foods like whole grains and most fruits score lower and lead to slower increases. To investigate long-term effects, researchers examined data from more than 200,000 adults in the United Kingdom who did not have dementia when the study began. Participants completed detailed questionnaires that allowed scientists to estimate the glycemic index and glycemic load of their regular diets. Over an average follow-up period of 13.25 years, 2,362 participants were diagnosed with dementia. Using advanced statistical methods, the research team identified the point at which higher dietary glycemic index values were linked to increased dementia risk. This approach helped clarify how long-term eating patterns may shape brain health later in life. The analysis revealed a clear pattern. Diets centered on lower glycemic index foods were associated with a reduced likelihood of developing dementia, while higher GI diets were linked to greater risk. People whose diets fell into the low to moderate glycemic range showed a 16% lower risk of developing Alzheimer's. In contrast, diets with higher glycemic values were associated with a 14% increase in risk. These results indicate that following a diet rich in low glycemic index foods, such as fruit, legumes, or whole grains, could decrease the risk of cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, and other types of dementia, said study leader Monica Bulo, who is a professor in the URV's Department of Biochemistry and Biotechnology, a researcher at ICREA, and director of the URV's Technotox Center. Overall, the findings underscore the importance of paying attention not only to how many carbohydrates people consume, but also to the type they choose. Incorporating carbohydrate quality into dietary strategies may be an important step in reducing dementia risk and supporting long-term brain health. Our next article is Resistant Starch in Diabetes, Glycemic Index. The source is glycemicindex.com. As explained in this month's Food for Thought, a resistant starch is the part of starchy foods that resist digestion in the small intestine. Instead, it acts in a similar way to dietary fiber, passing through the large bowel largely undigested, where it provides fuel for gut bacteria. Bacteria in the large bowel ferment and change the resistant starch into short-chain fatty acids, which have several health benefits, including protecting against digestive diseases and some types of cancer, for example, bowel. There is also evidence that resistant starch may help people with or at risk of diabetes. A review of 15 clinical trials found that supplementing the diet with resistant starch resulted in lowering fasting blood glucose levels, fasting insulin levels, and measures of insulin resistance in people with type 2 diabetes and obesity compared to a control group. However, no effect of resistant starch was seen in people who were overweight but didn't have diabetes. The researchers found that consuming 30 to 40 grams of resistant starch per day decreased fasting blood glucose levels, while only 10 grams per day were enough to lower fasting insulin levels. Exactly how resistant starch impacts blood glucose and insulin levels is unclear, but it may be via effects on gut bacteria. A review of research into the health benefits of resistant starch on diabetes and obesity via regulation of gut bacteria concluded that resistant starch may modify the gut microbiota, the microorganisms that live in our gut, to produce starch-degrading enzymes, promote the production of beneficial intestinal metabolites like short-chain fatty acids, improving gut barrier functioning, and reducing inflammation. However, further research is needed. I am Kate, and I hope you've enjoyed my reading of articles about diabetes today. Thanks for listening to the Talking Information Center.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is Bird Note. Though half the size of a robin, the Carolina wren has a powerful singing voice that seems to come from a much bigger bird. Many people remember their song with the phrase, "Tea kettle, tea kettle, tea kettle." They also have a distinctive call, a raspy sounding "chirr, chirr." When these secretive birds venture into the open, look for their cocked tail, bright white eyebrows, tan breasts, and golden brown backs. They're a common bird throughout parks and backyards in much of the eastern U.S. One reason these wrens thrive in cityscapes is their ability to build a nest in creative places. Everything from an old boot to a window flower box to an engine block are potential places to raise their brood. These little birds raise up to 7 tiny young at a time. If that nursery rhyme, you know, the old woman who lived in a shoe with so many children seemed silly to you, well, it certainly doesn't to the crafty, adaptable Carolina wren. Their many offspring appear, as if by magic, from the unlikeliest of places. For Bird Note, I'm Prabita Saha.
Hello, listeners. Would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.